Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here on this Monday. It's gorgeous Monday, I would say, at least out here in Washington. Getting ready to celebrate the 4th of July next Monday. So this is the vigil week of American independence. And I guess that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I don't know what it's actually called. Today is actually the feast of Cyril of Alexandria, who was, if memory serves, was one of our grumpier church fathers.
Oh yeah.
I
don't know anything about
him? Cyril of Alexandria. If Rod Bennett were here, he would know all of this stuff. Rod Bennett knows all these sorts of things. If memory serves, Cyril of Alexandria. Alexandria, it was an interesting place. Civic violence was sort of the municipal sport of Alexandria. And so Alexandria is famous, for example, for killing one of the greatest minds of antiquity in one of their frequent riots, Hypatia, who was a pagan philosopher, although probably had strong Christian sympathies. And Michael Flynn has actually written this whole story about the death, or not story, but this whole account of the death of Hypatia. And Hypatia later becomes sort of a martyr for people who don't actually know anything about history. Because she gets killed by this mob of Alexandrians who spent a lot of time killing each other. North African Christianity was kind of that way. It was just, it tended toward extremes. And so people got all head up about things. And so she got killed. And later she becomes, she sort of gets apotheosized into kind of, you know, the greatest mind, one of the greatest minds of antiquity, killed by Christians who just hated anybody who was able to think.
Right.
And while they were doing that, they burned down the library at Alexandria because they hate books and learning and everything. Well, it turns out, like, you know, she was killed by a mob. The mob was primarily Christians and so forth. She wasn't particularly killed because she was a pagan. She was killed because she wound up being identified with some party of some political dispute that was going on at the time, you know. And the Library of Alexandria actually was already long gone. In fact, it looks like the Library of Alexandria probably was gone by the time of Julius Caesar.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the Library of Alexandria is one of these things where people, almost everything that you think you know about the Library of Alexandria is like totally false. Uh-huh. And yeah, it was just one of those things where people, for whatever reason, you know, the Library of Alexandria suffered not really from Christian neglect. It was just one of those things for some reason or other. The Alexandrians didn't bother keeping it up. If you want to get an instructive case on what can happen to libraries, not due to, you know, Christian hordes or Visigoths or really anything like that, just take a look at there's some photographs of libraries in downtown Detroit right now that are just, they're just in ruins. And it's not because of anything. It's just because people just stop caring about keeping the library up.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so, anyway, I don't know how I got onto that tangent, but, Cyril of Alexandria.
Hey, I always like your tangents, Mark.
Oh, okay. Cyril of Alexandria.
Wait. Can I register a complaint? There's one tangent that I don't like.
Okay.
Okay. Are you ready? It's the thing about how the early Christians had the question about whether or not they should eat, meat that was dedicated to idols.
Okay.
And it's a very good illustration, but it doesn't illustrate everything. And I think that you think that it illustrates everything, and I have a quibble with that.
You know, that reminds me,
there's
a passage in 1 Corinthians that talks all about the question of whether or not Christians can eat meat dedicated to idols. But I won't go into that right now.
Yeah. Oh, well, tell us after the break, though, because I want
to
hear.
I'll tell you during the break, and then people don't have to suffer. Only you have to suffer.
I can take it.
Well, how are things with you out there? You must be, like, suffering with heat right now, right?
A little bit. It finally started to rain. It was hot last night, and we were being bombarded with bugs last night because we have this child in the house who loves nothing better than to go around poking holes in screens. So we have Christina and I are lying in bed. We're reading our books. And then every once in a while, one of us goes, ah! And, you know, jumps up and shakes our leg. Because drift off to sleep and then something goes zoom, right next to your head. It was pretty exciting for a while.
I think the ones that are the worst are the ones where you can actually hear their joints moving.
No!
They kind of plank, you know. Those are bad.
Many of those because it gets so cold here. Bugs don't have a chance to get big enough to have, like, you know, we don't. Everything dies once a year, or at least goes into hibernation, you know. So New Hampshire, once again, is paradise.
I find the whole life cycle of bugs to be amazing to me. Bugs, you know, they lay their eggs or do whatever it is they do, or they turn into larvae. And then you guys get, like, you know, these New Hampshire winters that go down to, like, below zero temperatures. And I'm thinking, how does any life out there survive?
It's amazing. There's a couple of weeks in spring where I just drive around with my mouth hanging open because things are, you could practically see things, like, it's like one of those old Disney cartoons where all the flowers are, like, stretching and yawning and putting their heads up. It's amazing. It's ridiculous. It's like, seeing the landscape coming back to life, going from, you know, black and white and brown and gray to suddenly this strange little, you can't even see green. There's just this sort of sensation of greenness around the edges. And then next week it's definitely green. It's starting to establish itself. And then the next week it's kablammo and everything is green and it's just waving and frothing all over the place. And there's 46 million different shades of green. And it's amazing. I love it here so much. Beautiful.
You just want, you know, the rite of spring playing in the background, you know. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. Well, I got to say, we're right now in Western Washington. This is exactly the time of year when I just don't understand why people live anywhere else on planet Earth. I just love Western Washington this time of year. It is the most gloriously gorgeous place on earth, and so I make the most of it. So you will always find me this time of year. I'm typically taking a walk somewhere, and either around a lake or through it. So I might even talk my wife into a swim this evening. I don't know. But no, I can't do that. She's got to go off and pray. Okay. Well, all right then, dear. You can go and be with God. It's
the same time, surely.
Well, yeah. Today is the day that needs it. This has been a tough day at the Shea household. So I just got back from a funeral for a friend of ours who died last week. He was, I got to say, we have this great, you know, the former priest at our parish, Dominicans circulate around a lot. So Father Daniel Seiverstadt was the guy who was presiding at the funeral service, a grade size service. So the wife is Catholic, the husband was not, but he came and prayed for him. And so I was asked to do the reading. So I did the reading. I was able to sort of muscle my way through the readings, you know, trying very hard not to get choked up in the readings, and just do your office and, you know, don't bump into the furniture was, you know, that's sort of my approach, you know, and, cause it was hard to do.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, and yet you look at his kids, he has two kids that are both, now they're young adults.
Yeah.
And, And it's just, you know, the son, it's just about exactly the age I was when I lost my father.
Oh, boy. So that brings back all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. So it brings back a lot of memories. And, you just feel the sadness of the world. And the funny thing is I like graveyards. Mm-hmm. Maybe that sounds weird, but I do. There's something, you know, deeply peaceful about a graveyard. And these are people who are at rest. And as a Catholic graveyard. So, it was just hard. And then we went down the hill and visited the grave of another friend who was taken far too soon, a mother of several children. And, and the gravestone says, we love you, Mom. And it's just...
Yikes.
Oh. Yeah. So I'm feeling pretty run out. But, we'll be back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots with Simca Fisher and me, Mark Shea, your host. We'll be back.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Simca Fisher. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. That's 1-573-4-BREAD-4. Operators are standing by. Give Ethan Boland something to do.
Yes.
He's. I always wonder what Ethan's doing while we're doing this show. Is he like... just doing Sudoku or what, you know? I don't even
How old is Ethan? I picture Ethan as like 26 or something. Am I in the right ballpark?
Could be. I don't know.
That's how you can tell what somebody is doing is how old they are. I think he's too old. I think he's too young for Sudoku.
Well, we sit here and we talk about him and you notice that he's not like bursting into the conversation. Yeah. Tells you. He's
probably in the bathroom right now.
He's doing Sudoku is what he's doing. So although I gotta say, Here's my joke for the day. I don't like Sudoku. I like real coup. Sudoku. Yeah, get it.
I get it.
It's a humor concept of funniness. Yeah. Oh. So, yeah. Anyway, the big news today is the Supreme Court ruling, yes, which I completely missed out on because I have spent the day at a funeral. And so I can't offer any intelligent commentary on it because I don't know what happened because I was at a funeral all day.
Well, I can sum it up pretty quick. It's just that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said that it was constitutional for Texas to say that abortion facilities had to have basically the same hygiene and cleanliness and surgical standards as any other ambulatory surgical facility. So anytime you go in there and a doctor gets into your insides, they have to have certain standards in case something goes wrong, which something often does during abortions. So they have to, for instance, the halls have to be wide enough so that if an ambulance gurney needs to come through to get you, to put you in an ambulance, the halls have to be wide enough to get the gurney through. And the doctor,
this all seems like a good thing.
Pretty basic stuff. And if right. the doctor who's performing the abortion should have clean hands. It should have admitting privileges at a hospital that's within 30 miles of it. So if something goes wrong, in other words, the same doctor can go in there and follow up with you rather than just dumping you, basically dumping you on the doorstep and saying, here's a lady.
Sorry, you're bleeding to death.
Right, exactly. Okay. And you guys figure out what's wrong with her and how to help her. This is what they're allowing right now. So went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reversed the Circuit Court of Appeals decision and said that it was unconstitutional, that it violated a woman's that it was an undue burden on her and violated her right to privacy, and that it was too much to ask for abortion clinics to have these standards. And so, I will tell you, Mark, the thing that really jumped out at me was that rich women who want to get abortions, or who do get abortions, because not all women who get abortions actually want them, they're going to have good clinics to go to. They're going to have safe, clean clinics to go to, and they're going to have doctors who have admitting privileges because they can pay for them. This, as everything that happens in this country lately, disproportionately is going to affect poor women.
Right.
And this is what happens when we're pushing for things that make it easier for people to get abortions, you're making it easier for poor women to get abortions, because we want poor women to get abortions, because we don't want poor women having babies. And I can tell you this firsthand, because I've been a poor woman having a baby at what the world considers the wrong time to have a baby. And I can tell you that the difference between being on insurance that the state provides, which is, you know, the bare minimum basically, and you go to the gross clinic in the gross part of town and you get treated like a gross thing, and the difference between that and having, you know, regular person's insurance where you get treated like a human being, it's a vast difference. And I was this was within the space of a couple of years, so I know what I'm talking about.
It's another
way of getting rid of poor women's babies, because we don't want poor women's babies. And in general, this means black women's babies, and it means Hispanic women's babies.
Right.
So, maybe I'm a little bit emotional about this, but I think some things are worth getting emotional about.
Yeah, well, no. I mean, this is another triumph of the rich over the poor, you know.
It is. It really is.
And, you know, in a lot of ways, I mean, this sounds like the Kermit Gosnell memorial law.
Right, exactly.
If only he had enjoyed those protections, he might still be in business, you know.
Talk about the war on women. I mean, it's so disingenuous when they talk about protecting women. They say they're protecting women, they're preserving women's rights. I mean, what? Women are not protected by abortion. Women are victimized by abortion, even when they do it consensually. You know, just because you sign your name on a piece of paper doesn't mean that it's... every abortion represents a failure for women. That's what it comes down to. Every time a woman finds herself in an abortionist clinic, that means that somebody, or more likely many, many people, have failed her. Yeah. And that's what it always comes down to. And it disproportionately falls on poor women and very young women who don't know any better and don't have anyone looking out for them. Hmm. So, thanks.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I am appalled, but I'm not surprised. You kind of figure that, this would happen because it's poor people. I mean, who cares? That's the approach, you know. If we can figure out some way to lay the disproportionate burden on poor people, we always figure out how to do it. So, well, I'm sorry to hear that. That's bad news.
I mean, they're not, you know, it's not the end, you know. That's the good thing about the system that we've got, the great lumbering, cumbersome, ridiculous system that we've got. It's never the end, you know.
Right.
I don't know how people do it who are on the front lines of the legal arm of the pro-life movement. There's lots of different ways to be pro-life, but the people who are on the trying to work the legal system and trying to go through the system, I honestly, my hat's off to you guys. I don't know how you get up in the morning and say, okay, let's try again.
Yeah.
But they do.
That'd be tiring.
Yeah.
Well, it's a shame. It's really a shame. You hope that, you know, maybe somewhere, I have no idea how the legal system works, but, you know, it just seems like such an outrageous thing to do, to say, you know, you don't need cleanliness standards, you know, or or health standards that you would, you know, that you have to have, you're going to have your ears pierced.
It only has to do with women. It only has to do with women. Nobody's arguing that, you know, places that do vasectomies or places that I'm trying to think of something that's unique to men, you know, something that only men have to put up with. Nobody is saying, well, we have to make sure that all men can get in, you know, into this something that's very, very close to a back alley because they have a right to be there. You know, it's just it comes down to a hatred of women, and it comes down to a hatred of fertility and the idea that fertility is a disease. And the only way that women are ever going to be able to have a meaningful life is if they don't have to have babies.
Yeah.
It's just the sickness of it is so deep and so profound that it's hard to talk about it without sounding like I sound right now. Like black and dark, I'm a prophet of doom.
That's right.
Like that.
Yeah.
But it's all true. But anyway, what I always tell my kids is that, you know, no matter how sad the chapter we're in right now, we already know how this story ends. We already know the end of this story. We know the end, and it's only a matter of deciding which side you're going to be on, the winning side or the losing side, because we know who wins.
Yeah, it's consoling to, at the end of the day, believe in the conquest of death. I guess you could say that that's a real advantage, you know, conquering death and all, you know, that seems like that's a hopeful thing. You know? Let's see. We've got various questions and comments from your readers today. We've already responded to the first one, because that was the first thing that somebody wanted to hear about was the SCOTUS ruling. Thank you for knowing what you're talking about, because I've just been out of the loop today because of the funeral. Speaking of conquest of death, and
you know, I was going to say that is why it's cemeteries are good places to be in. I mean, I grew up across the street from a cemetery. We used to play in it. We would play tag and we'd have picnics and stuff and read books. And
really?
We felt very comfortable there. And this was kind of shocking to my husband because he didn't grow up in any such place. And he felt like you had to sort of tiptoe around and whisper around if you wanted to be respectful of the dead. But there's different ways of being respectful of the dead. And one way is to acknowledge that death is a bad thing, but it's not the final thing.
It's not
the only thing, and it's fitting for a cemetery to be sort of in the middle of the town where we can all walk past it, because death and life go on simultaneously. You know what I mean? But we know how this story ends, and we know which side is victorious in the end, and it's, you know, we're just unlucky enough to have to watch it playing out.
I think that's one of the great. We'll continue this conversation in just a minute. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Simca Fisher. And we'll be back right after this. Take it, Ludwig.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today talking with Simca Fisher. We're looking through some of the So somebody wants to know about the recent statement by Pope Francis. These things always happen aboard airplanes. Reminds me of one of my favorite Eye of the Tiber headlines. Swiss Guard Swiss guard. It was a Pope Francis struck by tranquilizer dart. Aboard airplane during, as he begins to go off script during an airplane interview, the Swiss guard are standing by with tranquilizer darts just to keep it from going too far off script. And I gotta say, I mean, I'm a big fan of the airplane interviews. I love watching people scramble around in panic while that guy just holds forth on whatever. And anyway, apparently recently he made the remark, which to me is uncontroversial, about, you know, some Christians need to make apologies for the way that they've treated gay people.
Yeah.
And it's like, why, you know, it's like, this, to me, this is like a duh.
Right. Yep.
Kind of thing to say. It's like, of course, you know, but everybody's having a cow about it because somehow or other, this is blaming us for shooting up a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, and all this stuff. And it's like, that's not
saying it. To apologize for teaching that homosexual behavior is immoral, that which right. is certainly not what he was saying, because in the catechism, it says that, which I don't have the quote right in front of me, but that, you know, it is, we have a responsibility to treat people, homosexual people, with dignity and respect, just like anybody else, because they're people just like anybody else.
Right.
So it doesn't, it's, you know, you commit or may be committing or maybe have a temptation to commit this particular sin. Therefore, I'm allowed to say anything I want to because you're disgusting. That seems to be the way that some people are living out their faith and bringing Christ into the world. And that's not, that's not cool, and that's pretty much all the Pope was
not
saying.
Cool.
Not cool. Not cool, man, says the Holy Spirit.
That's right. Yeah, and that's really it, you know. You know, and I see this, you know, I see this a lot. I see homosexuality for a certain stripe of Christian is the only sin where merely experiencing the temptation is the same as committing the sin.
Right.
And it's like, that's not cool, man. You know, that's, it's not the way we treat any other sin. In Catholic tradition, what we believe is that merely to experience a temptation to do something, that's not sin. That's called concupiscence. Concupiscence is the darkened intellect, weakened will, and disordered appetites that are part of the consequences of original sin, but they're not sin.
Right.
They're what's called, what the tradition calls it, is the tinder for sin. And when you resist the darkened intellect, weakened will, and disordered appetites of concupiscence, and live virtuously, live in obedience to Christ, you're actually, this is called meritorious. You have done something heroic. You have received grace and acted on grace, and you're becoming more saintly when you do that, not more sinful. And yes, so,
if you're a guy who's attracted to women and you never sleep with men and you never want to sleep with men, you don't get any points for that at all.
No points for that.
Like, I was not impressed. Like,
you did not resist any temptation, you know.
Sex trees, array for you, you know.
Yeah.
This doesn't make you into a hero, exactly.
And yet, so often I see, you know, I see this repeatedly. I've seen people like Eve Tushnet, for example. She's a rather famous Catholic. She self-identifies as gay. She wrote a book called Gay and Catholic. But she's chaste. She lives according to the teaching of the church. She hasn't done anything wrong.
No.
And yet, I see her getting dissed a lot. Well, she says she's gay. Well, okay, so what? Well, she shouldn't say that word. Well, why not? I mean, that's, you know, that's so she's pointing out the reality of her sexual orientation, but she also lives faithfully according to the teaching of the church. She hasn't done anything wrong. And when you punish people who are trying to live according to the teaching of the church for their temptations, well, golly, why would gays get the impression that there's just nothing they can ever do to be pleasing?
I know, so they might as well leave the church. They might as well stop believing in God. They might as well never. Right. Yeah. I know. I mean, it's exactly the opposite of here. Where I found the quote. It says that. Wait a minute. I had it a second ago. Men and women with homosexual tendencies must be accepted with respect, compassion, and sensitivity. Every sign of unjust discrimination in their regard should be avoided. I mean, that's pretty strongly worded. It doesn't say anything about, like, you know, what I keep on running into is people who are very, very careful not to hang around with people who consider themselves gay, whether they're acting on it or not, whether they're living chaste lives or not. They're very, very careful not to spend any time with them or talk to them about it because they don't want to be contaminated by it. But all of a sudden, but at the same time, all of a sudden, when people who do consider themselves gay call themselves gay, they say, well, let me tell you why that's wrong. I'm like, how did you get to be an expert if you don't even hang around with them? How is it that you know more about this and what it signifies? And what it means and why you would want to do such a thing as to call yourself gay, as to identify yourself as gay, if you refuse to even be in the same room with them. You know, I get very, very frustrated with it. And I was especially disgusted and dismayed that people were bringing up that argument that they shouldn't call themselves gay because being gay means acting gay, and acting gay is a sin. Not that they even got that subtle about it. They were bringing up this argument literally within hours of the 49 people who were shot in that nightclub.
Oh, it was appalling.
Blood was still flowing, and they were saying, "Well, let me discuss how they talk about themselves."
I got an email, or not an email, but somebody on my Facebook. You know, it's always these guys that you just get the sense that, you know, zero social skills. This guy shows up, super hardcore. Arch reactionary Catholic, and his big question, the question that was haunting his mind was, well, sure, it's wrong to go in and just shoot gay people, but isn't there some way that we could see too that they were properly hanged? And I was like, what is wrong with you? Are you insane? You know, but that was it. That was a big question. And so, you know, when Pope Francis comes out and says, Christians owe gay people an apology. That's the first thing that I thought of was, you know, that deserves an apology. And it's a weird thing because for some people, there are certain sins that it doesn't matter whether you commit them or not. The mere fact that you're tempted by them, that's the same as committing them. And it's like, God forbid the rest of us have to be judged on that, because who should escape whipping,
or
Shakespeare
even,
puts it.
It's even a matter of, okay, so maybe some people do commit sins and then they repent of them and they try to do better. I mean, that's also considered a holy act, is to repent, to amend your life. So even if we're talking about people who have succumbed to it in one way or another, you know, it's just, it's the whole idea of minding other people's souls. It's just like, who has time for that? You know, my soul.
Some people have lots of time for it, ever so much time. But so I was proud of Pope Francis for saying that. And I was also, I got to add, I was super proud of Pope Francis for going to Armenia and saying in Armenia that the Armenian genocide was a genocide.
Yeah. Yeah.
And bravo, you know, and the Turks were really mad and they recalled their ambassador. And I was like, you rock. Way to go. That's, you know, I love being Catholic. You know? So good job, Pope Francis.
Oh,
let's see. Other questions. Well, there are lots of questions for people trying to figure out how to listen to us. But if you're hearing this, here's an interesting one. The TV series, I don't know if you've seen this, the TV series on Netflix. Is it Netflix or maybe it's on Amazon? I can't remember. It's one of those streaming things called The Man in the High Castle.
Oh, is it that the Nazi thing?
Yeah, Philip K. Dick, science fiction writer, fantasy writer. And he's responsible. He also is the guy that wrote Blade Runner. Or wrote the story that Blade Runner is based on, and AI was also based on a story that he wrote. And The Man in the High Castle is one of his as well. And yeah, it's basically it's an alternative history in which the Nazis won World War II.
Right.
And so now the United States is the United States east of the Rocky Mountains is under Nazi rule. And then the Rocky Mountains are sort of a demilitarized zone. And then west of the Rockies is Japanese territory. And we'll talk about it when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Simca Fisher. And we'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Simca Fisher. If you want to give us a call or if you want to text us, you can do so at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. This is your chance to ask Simca Fisher about that thing that you've been dying to ask
do it,
about.
Do it.
Yeah, and you can also text us at Breadbox Media. I was telling Simca, I was going somewhere before the end of the last segment. I was in the middle of a story, which I can't remember now, because I fell to telling...
Man in the High Tower, Nazis. You were talking
Man in the High Tower, Nazis. Yeah, so anyway, it's an interesting story of, you know, what might have been had the Nazis won World War II and dropped the atomic bomb on Washington, D.C., and using their, you know, V-2 missiles and so forth. And so the first season they've already shown. There's going to be a second season, and the plot is thoroughly thickened at the end of the first season. It's a very, as you might guess, it's a brutal world. One that's ruled by Nazis. There's a kind of an unforgettable scene at one point where somebody is driving across the U.S. and he stops in this little town and he's talking to somebody. And while they're talking, it starts to snow.
Oh, yes, that's so far.
And then you realize it's not snow; it's ash, and it's from the it's from the disposal crematoria. At one of the local camps, and that's what's coming down. And
and it's just business as usual. Nobody.
It's just business. Yeah, everybody's just like, oh yeah, you know.
And this is, by the way, this is a gorgeous, beautiful, stylized, very stylish, very very polished, arty looking show. I think it's 3 or 4 episodes of it.
Yeah.
And I turned away. It was very beautiful. It's nice to now, boy, this is a really good time to be watching TV. There's so many beautiful shows for people who just want to sit there and, you know, show me beautiful pictures and I'll think about the story later, which is me. This is a great time to be alive.
Yes. So then moving on from there, over the break, I was telling Simca in another vein entirely.
Okay, I was trying to remember what the connection was, and I'm kind of glad to hear that there is no
connection, actually. It's just, I thought, you know, instead of talking about ugly Nazi things, we could talk about my adorable granddaughter, Seraphim, who is, I must say, super adorable. And my son, who is a far better father than I was, just adores her and dotes on her. And it shows in the way that she is. She's super confident. She's very good little. She's just a good little girl with a with an inquisitive, interested mind in everything. And
objectively, you're reporting this as an unimpassioned observer.
It's just a, I'm totally unbiased, but he was saying, you know, the other day, apparently she got up, she does this, she gets up in the middle of the night and climbs out of her bed while mom and dad are asleep. And so the other day, her mother had been teaching her, she's two. Yeah. So her mother had been teaching her how to break eggs. And she figured out how to open the baby gate to the kitchen. So she went in, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, she went in there and she got out a container of 18 eggs, and she practiced breaking eggs like her mom had taught her to do. And so she broke 18 eggs all over the floor in the kitchen. And then she found the peanut butter and brought that out into the living room. And when she was done doing whatever it was she was doing with the peanut butter, she just sort of turned it upside down on the rug and just kind of let it ooze out onto the rug. And she also got some pastrami out of the meat drawer and put that on the bookshelf for some reason that's unclear. And then she went back to bed. And so they got up the next morning. She's sound asleep, you know, in her little bed. And they went out into the living room and they found the destruction. And but, you know, my son is like, yeah, it was just, it was funny. You know, she's just so bright and she's learning how to do what her mom taught her to do. There's some rough edges, you know, that she needs to work off. But she's getting there, you know, she's figuring things out. And she's super adorable. And her little, she has this just complete butterball of a younger sister who was born in December, who is, she's toothless and has this giant happy grin all the time. And these are just children that they, you could just tell that these are kids who know that they're deeply loved.
Yeah.
I marvel at it. I marvel at how my son is raising his kids and how they're already showing the marks of being smart, healthy, confident, happy, bright little kids. And
tell a story about how I'm raising my kid, Corey. Okay. 15 months old. She's I don't know what her deal is. She's teething or something. She's doing something lately. So she has been getting up to nurse in the middle of the night again, which she hadn't been doing for a while. So the other night, I'm kind of grumpily nursing her. She's nursing. And then finally, she pauses for a minute and she sort of, you know, unlatches. And she opens her eyes and looks at me and says, "Batman." And then she goes back to nursing again. I was not thinking about Batman, mm-hmm. but apparently you were while you were nursing, you weirdo. I love the fact that everything is on the same, like, little kids don't prioritize at all. Like, everything is present and equally important to them, you know? Like, everything is relevant. Everything is relevant all the time to little kids. And it's so bizarre to see their brains just like, they're like those little, those push toys that you push them around and they go pop, 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 and the little balls come up and you can watch them popping up under the dome. That's what their brains are like. Yeah. Just, you never know what's going to pop up next. So it's always something. My four-year-old has been playing these elaborate, intense pretend games lately, and she'll have, you know, a couple of bananas and a couple of forks or something like that. But she was at the beach with my husband the other day, and she had, they catch salamanders at the beach, and she had three. They were named like Thunder and something.
Thunder.
One was named Thunder, one was named something, and one was named Love Potion, I guess, which I don't know where that came from. But they were getting married, because salamanders have to get married if they're going to be together in the same jar. They better get married, because
you
know, in the world of salamanders, there are still some standards left, apparently.
Well, that's good to know, you know?
You know, I'll take my reassurance where I can get it. Still honor among salamanders, anyway. Our civilization is still hanging together. So there's something Anyway, this little boy says, "Can I play with you? I have a salamander too." So he comes up with his salamander and she says, "Did you kiss the salamander?" He's like, "No." He's like, "Well, is the salamander in love?" He's like, "No." This poor little boy, he's about the same age, but he's kind of on a different track from where my 4-year-old is on right now.
It's all
weddings all the time with her. It's hilarious.
She's into
a wedding. I don't know where she gets it from, but she's just very married. You know,
it's something about it. I mean, they say that, you know, we have to like deny and suppress these gender differences because of, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, good luck, you know. I'm sorry, but there's just something hardwired into a lot of girls, you know.
And
a lot of boys about this kind of stuff. Boys will turn everything into a gun.
Yeah. Yes. Oh yes. Oh my goodness. I've seen them. You know, you give a little boy a piece of bread and he bites it into a gun shape.
Yeah.
I have seen little girls they had dinosaurs. They would take dinosaurs and they were cradling them and wrapping them up and putting them in their cribs. And them. But
they're great.
Really, what is this? A baby, though? Don't you see? It's a baby.
Oh man! Well, you know, we got a couple of minutes left. Do you want me to talk about how tattoos are related to the issue of eating meat that's been sacrificed to idols, or is this...
Can you do it in rhymed couplets?
I can't do it in rhymed couplets, but we can talk briefly about... So, Simka, tattoos, yes or no, pro or con?
Oh my gosh. You know, I'll tell you, here's my personal experience with tattoos. I was in a tattoo parlor about to get a tattoo, and I was flipping through the album because I hadn't made up my mind completely yet. And I said to myself, if I can't decide right now when I'm in the tattoo parlor, what are the choices that I'm going to still be happy with my decision? You know, I was 25
years
old, and I had a pretty long life in front of me. So I said, maybe I'll wait a little bit. And I have been waiting ever since. And that's my story.
Yeah,
I've cultivated the skill of not jumping to conclusions about people based on their appearance, and I have mental tricks that I play on myself, and I tell myself certain things, and I'm very good at setting aside my first, because we all have first ideas when we look at somebody, and our first impressions of people based on their outward appearances are often wrong.
Yeah. Well, we will continue this discussion of tattoos perhaps some other day. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Simka. Our producer today was Ethan Boland. Ethan may or may not have a tattoo. I don't know. But I'll be back tomorrow with Tom McDonald. Until then, thanks for listening. Bye.